the Ensemble Intercontemporain with Stravinsky's Dumbarton Oaks. And that is it for today. I do hope you'll join me next Sunday from 10.
Sunday Morning with Susie Klein was produced for Radio 3 by Perfectly Normal Productions, with studio production today by Lyndon Jones.
Unique performances.
Unique performances.
Emerging artists.
Emerging artists.
New voices.
New voices.
World-class musicians.
World-class musicians.
Radio 3 at WOMAD. A vibrant mix of music from every corner of the planet. Live coverage of the UK's biggest world music festival. Radio 3 brings WOMAD to you. All weekend, exclusive to BBC Radio 3. Find out more at bbc.co.uk/radio3.
And we have two visits to WOMAD today, just after the 1 o'clock news. That's to say, in an hour's time, and then again at 11:30 tonight. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
William Orbit has a terrific track record as a musician, composer and producer. He's given his personal touch to the likes of Madonna, Blur and U2. You've always had a long fascination for classical music too, William, haven't you? In fact, this fascination for classical music has always gone hand in hand with your work in the pop world, or has it been something you've just nurtured quietly on the side?
I think it might be two different sets of circuits in the brain, although I suppose some of the melodic structural aspects of classical music might inform the pop music. I'm not sure. I think they're rather different. But yes, I've nurtured it as my private passion.
And in fact, you've been going to the proms and things like that like a mad thing, haven't you?
My favourite spot is right, the cheap seats, right by the orchestra on the left or the right, for instance, right by the brass, where all you can really hear is the brass, but you get to see everything. You get to see the face of the conductor. I love it.
How did you come to work with the people I was mentioning? Is it because there was something about the way you produced your own work or other people's work that brought their attention to what you do?
I started remixing compulsively with little regard to any deals or anything. And even without the internet, which of course everything gets disseminated so effectively now, but even then tapes passed around and eventually they started to come to me. And remixing turned into production. You know, there's a kind of link. And once you've done somebody who's well-known as one that says some form, things tend to escalate and you get asked more often.
You also have had great fun taking well-known classical pieces of music and investing it in your own image, as it were. I mean, that's not to say that you destroy the basic idea, but you either give it a beat or a back tempo and just give it a sort of freshening up.
Sometimes it's a beat. Sometimes it's the matter of transposing everything, you know, wildly in a different octave, and obviously timbres, you know, change. It's the most enjoyable project that I engage on, this particular series.
And do you think that opens up classical music to another audience?
Apparently so. I was chatting with a lady who had worked at HMV in Oxford Street for many years, and she said, oh, well, you're the person that everybody, you know, but many people come in and refer to and say, oh, I've got William Orbit's piece of whatever, could I get the original? So apparently so, but it wasn't my intention.
Thank you.
part of Aquarium, the Saint-Saëns Carnival of the Animals movement, which appears on Pieces in a Modern Style, Volume 2, by William Orbit. The piece that turned me on to want to be a composer, or rather the music that did, was that of Stravinsky. Oh. So I was quite happy to see that he's the first choice. What was it for you that made you choose this?
Just the fact that you always know it's Stravinsky, and yet in surprising ways. I mean, he never seems to cliche himself, and yet you know it's him, and there's this unstoppable, maniacal mischievousness about it all, even when it's at its most dark. I mean, I really, really love the symphony in three movements, and it's got this unstoppable brutality about it, which I guess figures because it was written during the war, about the war, which is going on at the time. But nevertheless, there's still that sense of a sort of, is playfulness the right word?
Yeah, he did. He always had a wicked glint in his eye.
That might have been the ladies, of course. I've read the biography.
That glint was also there. But he could be... There was an element of cruelty about him. You know, one reads about his life. And I remember he wrote a piano concerto for his son, Sulima, and he always refused to dedicate it to him. It's just a kind of little sort of turning of the knife. You know, it's a strange characteristic. But if you listen to the music... And it goes back to all that, if you think of the Rite of Spring, the sort of, you know, the primitive violence in that, which is just underneath the surface always, isn't it?
Yes, there are brutal... there are so many chords, I think, in terms of chords, you know, and there are so many chords which you could say were cruel. I did watch this incredible documentary by Tony Palmer, and actually I did notice that when his son was speaking, he seemed quite cowed. He seemed like a man whose childhood hadn't been easy.
The other thing you were talking about was the recognisability, and I'm interested in that, because for somebody that spends their life listening to sound, somehow it's the voicing very often of the chord, isn't it? You can always, I mean, sometimes, you know, like the end of Symphony of Psalms, you'd have the flutes, a third, but two octaves above anything else. Nobody else would have dared to do that.
Look at the introduction, the chords of the piece for wind instruments. It's, there's an extra octave in there, and that's something I love to do. I mean, if you take... to a chord and you sort of turn it inside out so the top becomes the bottom, but, you know, a long way off. It's very exciting, and I think I got that idea from listening to Stravinsky.
So this particular piece, what was it here that this particular moment we've chosen?
Apparently he didn't write thematic music at all. He just wrote pieces, but this one was thematic, and you really do see the armies mustering. There's this, I'm not sure if it's a trumpet, that kind of like spikes out of this piece where all the sort of instruments go down in level, but they're kind of mustering as if for an assault. And I also like that. I like that sense of war with its battles and its waiting. And I like the bass. I like what the bass is doing down there.
Music from the first movement of the Symphony in Three Movements by Stravinsky. We heard the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Sir Eugene Goossens. You're absolutely right, because Stravinsky did, on the whole, see himself as a kind of neoclassicist, and therefore the idea of writing programmatic music, apart from ballets, of course, was rather foreign. But there is a definite menace of marching men there.
They caught a glint of sunlight on a sort of shiny gun barrel at one point.
One of the series of discs you made, which I know people are very attracted to, who know a bit about the business, is the Strange Cargo series. Tell me a little bit about that, how that came about.
Well, I had a studio and I loved to record, and I didn't have a band, so I did instrumental music, the genre which is now so prevalent. It wasn't at the time. How did it start? I think it was a soundtrack for a film, my only soundtrack. And I kind of took it further when the film was said and done. And there's no reason behind it. My accountant in the difficult times would say, you really don't need to do these. You should be doing a proper job of music. Over the years, they've kind of, because I've done a series, it's a thing that I just do.
But you've had some wonderful collaborators, singers.
Yes, there's been Beth Orton. Started with her when she was very young. It was her first singing experience when she was 19. She was been an actress before that. And Laurie Mayer, who I've worked with, she's been on many other records. Yes, there are vocals on it, and they never take centre stage, as it were.
So do you sometimes see the voice as another instrument rather than necessarily being the central crux of it?
I'm not sure if I see it. Well, yes, it is an instrument, but it's not meant to replace an instrument. It's more and a more oblique view of things. That play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and there's this, they're the two peripheral characters who suddenly take centre stage, and then there's kind of Hamlet wandering along muttering to himself, which is actually when he's doing his soliloquy. And sometimes I feel like music, you can take that approach to music. You can just shift the viewpoint. But I love working with vocals. I like it when singers allow me to experiment with them. Yes, I do think it's an instrument sometimes. And when they allow me to experiment then I'm very grateful.
The next music, William Orbit, is from a film, unless we've got the initial idea of including it.
Yes. Well, this is where the sacrifice for music reaches its pinnacle, because this is a film of Farinelli, the great castrato from the 18th century. And it's almost like the rap scene now is very competitive and combative with the music. I mean, they have face-offs and battles. And this is something that I believe they had in the 18th century with opera singers. I mean, they were competing to get the most notes in and to get the highest register and so on. And the film Farinelli is a well-made film. It's a beautiful film. And in it, there is this piece of music.
So it immediately struck you, this music, then, as being...
I loved the chords. I loved the inevitability of the chords and the grace of the chords and the way the oboe, or if it's an English horn, seems to capture the cadence of a vocal. It doesn't. It has embellishments, but not too many, because I don't like it when things get too ornate musically. And it's got this totally restrained vibrato. There's barely a trace of vibrato. And it, for me, is a wonderfully listenable two piece of music.
Thank you. It sounds to me like a Baroque oboe. But the interesting thing is that's the film and the disc of the film where they used two voices, didn't they, and synthesised them, as it were, together, or married them somehow, to try and create an authentic version of what the castrato might have sounded like.
Yes, I guess the one for the top end and one for the bottom.
That's right, yes.
It's got a touch of beautiful discord about the chords there. And not like Stravinsky or anything, but just something where they just rub together and then resolve.
That was Alto Giove from Polifemo, Act 3, by Nicolas Porpora, and we heard Les Talents Lyriques, directed from the harpsichord by Christophe Rousset. Recently, you've ventured into writing purely orchestral music, haven't you?
I had a crack at writing a symphony. I think I took on rather a lot for the first time, and it was a 9-movement piece with a full orchestra, an augmented orchestra, in fact, 104 musicians and a choir for performance in Manchester with the BBC Philharmonic. And they were fabulously supportive, and the conductor, Alexandra Shelley, was marvellous. You know, he taught me a lot. But I think I took on rather a lot, and I neglected some of the heart of it, the compositional side of it, and, you know, because I was learning, you know, about what the instruments could do and what you could do with them. So I have mixed feelings about it. A good collegiate experience for me, but I wouldn't recommend anybody go and listen to the entire thing.
So the idea of writing an opera, actually, would be another stage further on, because that would be a marriage of the two to a certain extent.
I've given it some thought. The Alex Poots, who was the impresario who put this, you know, helped me with the orchestra, he actually told me, he said, William, an opera will take you 2.5 years to do, minimum, so you need to be committed. And I've borne that in mind, but if I have a spare 2.5 years, I feel like I might just come up with something.
I don't know how long Bellini took to write Sonnambula, but that's your next choice, isn't it, or music from it?
Yeah.
And once again, you were struck, I think, by the chord structure. It's very interesting. You often come back to that, don't you, in your choice?
I think a reliance on chords is something from the 60s. I mean, pop music, as well as classical music, was very much about the melody, the top line, until the 60s came along, and it was all about chords. And I can't help but notice that in this piece, the chords are very simple. They're arpeggiated, they're very simple and very supportive of the melody. And that really appeals to me as well.
Ah, non credea mirati, from La Sonnambula, Act 2, by Bellini. We heard the incomparable Maria Callas. People always talked about her great dramatic skill, but there was there a real genuine beauty of tone too, wasn't there?
There's a debate about that, isn't it? I mean, from the very first note of that, you pay attention. It's just magical. When she gets to the end and there's that, don't know what you call that technique, but when the notes become thick and fast and there's no accompaniment, it does sound like there's a bit of effort going on there. You sort of think that other singers might be able to do it more effortlessly, but it doesn't matter because you feel her pain.
The drama is in the voice.
It's in the voice. Yeah.
She was singing there with the orchestra of the Teatro alla Scala Milan, conducted by Antonino Votto. Now, William Orbit, I know you have a fondness for Mozart's clarinet writing. What makes his clarinet writing even more extraordinary is that the instrument was only invented during his lifetime.
Oh, that I didn't know.
Yeah, so in other words, when he started, it didn't exist. So he had to create a new kind of colour in his head.
This is what throws me. Did he actually play it? I mean, could he operate the thing?
No, he was a string player, but there was a wonderful player called Anton Stadler, who became a virtuoso, who I think showed him, you know, what could be done.
I think of the clarinet quintet, the clarinet concerto, Sinfonia Concertante. These works, I know them so well. They were played in my household when I was young a lot, and it was always a good experience hearing those, and I cherish them.
But I think your point is absolutely right, that how extraordinary that a composer should come across this instrument midlife, as it were, and make two or three of the world's greatest masterpieces for the instrument almost instantly. But that is the hallmark of a great composer, that he can take a colour and blend it into his language.
Probably in his head. He had a clarinet in his head, you know. I mean, there's this liquidity about these pieces of music, and yet you imagine a prototype of anything, it probably had a squeaky and clunkiness about it because it was a prototype. It really, as you say, had been invented. It's quite a complex piece of machinery.
Well, and I think every composer is always looking for something that will extend the sound world, you know. Benjamin Britten did it, we're going to hear it, talking about him later. He was very good at taking instruments and seeing how far they could go.
As a record producer, I work with lots of artists who are writing songs, and I always say, when you buy a new piece of kit, you buy a new synthesizer or whatever, any instrument, you get a new instrument, make sure you're ready to record and write then, because you will get ideas, you'll get a flow from that. Your fingers will hear these new sounds and they'll do the walking, and it's a special moment. So there we are with Mozart. Obviously, he's as if he needed inspiration anyway, but he must have just fired him up to another level.
The second movement from the clarinet quintet in A major, Kirkel 581, by Mozart. We heard David Schifrin playing the clarinet with the Emerson string quartet. Of course, it's got such a sort of liquid range, the clarinet too, hasn't it? Mm. Down into the alto, like the violas, and then effortlessly up into the higher registers too.
Yeah. If I feel time of duress or the weight of the world on my shoulders, I only have to listen to a piece of music by Mozart such as that, and everything seems okay.
Awful when one thinks that a man of such talent died in a pauper's grave.
It seems impossible. Mm. I mean, it couldn't happen nowadays if he was around, because his music would have been heard by everybody on the internet. Mm. He didn't have that.
Now, the next artist that we're going to hear, William, you may have to tell us a little bit about, although I do know of her. She is actually more famous in America, even though she's British.
Yes, she's, one of the category of artists called, I suppose, singer-songwriter, employing a very electronic palette. This particular piece of music is, well, I say a cappella, it's actually, she's kind of electronically stacked up her vocals, so it has quite a synthetic timbre, but the composition is absolutely fantastic, and listen, because it's as if, once you get used to that sound, the fact that she's, as I say, she's turned her voice into an organ, actually serves to enhance the nuances of what she's saying and her lyrics as well.
Where are we? What the hell is going on? The dust has only just begun to fall. Crop circles in the carpet. Sinking feeling. Spin me round again and rub my eyes. This can't be happening. When busy streets a mess with people would stop to hold their heads heavy. Hide and seek. Trains and sewing machines. What did she say? words keep falling out your mouth. Bit sweet talk news, people are gods.
People are gods.
Speak no feeling, no, I don't believe you. You don't care a bit, you don't care a bit. Words keep falling out your mouth. Bit sweet talk news, people are gods. Speak no feeling, no, I don't believe you.
That was wonderful. How did she do that? I mean, it's not just multi-tracking, is it?
I think she's used a vocoder to take her vocal and put it on the keys, as it were, so she's able to harmonise with herself in perfect synchronicity with the lead vocal.
And to bend the notes and so forth.
I mean, it's a technology that is very much everywhere in pop music, but very rarely ever done with such finesse as this. And, you know, she's used the technology well, but it's about the composition. And as I say, the subtleties, it's beautifully recorded as well, but, you know, you don't miss a molecule of what she's putting across, even though it's so surrounded in this cloud of technology.
Hide and Seek from Imogen Heap. Now we're going to hear another group who are fantastically gifted vocally. The 16,
yes,
conducted by Harry Christophers. What is this music, William?
This is a piece of music written by Jean Mouton, a French composer from late 15th century, early 16th century, and it's a motet. And I'm not quite sure what a motet means, but I do know that the piece is written for four voices, and what they sing is repeated by another four voices, two bars later, and transposed up a fifth, and that's eight singers singing this complex canon. And yet, cerebral though that sounds, it sounds like somebody's kind of conceit. It's beautiful, and it touches the heart, and it's a warm and graceful piece nonetheless.
Thank you.
Nessien's Martyr by Jean Mouton, beautifully sung by the 16 and Harry Christophers. And there again, William Orbit, you get those slightly clashing suspensions, don't you, in that music, which gives it that little frisson.
Yes, and the words, the vowel sounds of the particular words also has an effect on how you perceive those frissons. To me, it seems, I mean, they're singing the Latin, so you don't, I don't know what they're singing about, but it's part of it. I've worked with them. I really enjoyed it, the power, the force that they are. I mean, it was a wonderful experience, and it was very
What did
enjoyable.
You do?
I did a concert at the Queen Elizabeth Hall, and then we recorded it, and they sung on the track. It's odd, because everybody knows Spem in Alum by Thomas Tallis, and this sounds similar to me, but it predates it. And I have this idea, I love to think of this, somehow the young Tallis, who would have been 15, had heard this piece and influenced him. And I think, how could that have happened? And I read that the huge event of the early 16th century, when they had the Field of Cloth of Gold, when the two kings took their entire courts to this place in France and just basically showed off their cultural world to each other, the King of France must have had this performed. And if Thomas Tallis had tagged along with the English team, as it were, he would have, as a bright young musician at 15, it would have really influenced him.
Perhaps that was the then version of Glastonbury.
Yes.
Your parents were very keen on Britain and that sort of Auden set too, weren't they?
They were, and they're school teachers. They're retired now, and they wanted to get a small cottage in the countryside. And they love Britain country, as I think of it, as around Suffolk. And they ended up getting a tiny, tiny cottage just near Southwold, and they go to Snape Maltings a lot. And they played a lot of Benjamin Britten when I was a child, and they loved him, and I do too.
Now, this, what we're going to hear, is his... It's very interesting, because actually the line through all of this is his soundtrack, isn't it?
Yes.
For that famous Night Mail, which Auden wrote the words for. Documentary about the working of the GPO, as it then was. And actually, it's got huge vigour and also humour in it, don't
you? Yes. Yes, it does. And, you know, it's you really do think of that. It had to be a steam train. Mm. And because, you know, you can hear the steam. And it's fantastic. I mean, is it Nigel Hawthorne, the narrator? He's reading the words of W.H. Auden. And I get the sense the conductor's just pacing things, just watching, just on his eye of the narrator to sort of see if he can trip him up. And he doesn't quite trip up. And it's fantastic.
This is the night mail crossing the border, bringing the check and the postal order. Letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop at the corner and the girl next door. Pulling up beat a steady climb, the gradient's against her, but she's on time. Through sparse countries she rampages, her driver's eye upon her gauges, panting up past lonely farms, fed by the farmer's restless arms, striding forward along the rails, through southern uplands with northern mails. Winding up the valley to the watershed, through the heather and the weather and the dawn overhead, past cotton grass and moorland boulder, shoveling the white steam over her shoulder, snorting noisily she passes, silent miles of wind-bent grasses, birds turn their heads as she approaches, stare from the bushes at her blank-faced coaches. Sheepdogs cannot turn her course, they slumber on with paws across, in the farm she passes, no one wakes, but a jug in a bedroom gently shakes. Dawn freshens, the climb is done. Down towards Glasgow she descends, towards the steam tugs, yelping down the glade of cranes, towards the fields of apparatus. The furnace is set on the dark plain like gigantic chessmen. All Scotland waits for her, in the dark glens, beside the pale green sea lochs, men long for news. Letters of thanks, letters from banks, letters of joy from the girl and boy, receipted bills and invitations to inspect new stock or to visit relations, and applications for situations, and timid lovers' declarations, and gossip, gossip from all the nations. News circumstantial, news financial, letters with holiday snaps to enlarge, and letters with faces scrawled in the margin, letters from uncles, cousins, and aunts, letters to Scotland from south of France, letters of condolence to Highlands and Lowlands, notes from overseas to Hebrides, written on paper of every hue, the pink, the violet, the white, and the blue, the catty, the chatty, the boring, adoring, the golden official, the hearts outpouring, clever, stupid, short and long, the typed and the printed and spelt all wrong. Thousands are still asleep, dreaming of terrifying monsters, or a friendly tea beside the band at Cranston's or Crawford's. Asleep in working Glasgow, asleep in well-set Edinburgh, asleep in granite Aberdeen, they continue their dreams, but shall wake soon and long for letters. And none will hear the postman's knock without a quickening of the heart. For who can bear to feel himself forgotten?
The end sequence from Night Mail by Benjamin Britten, words, of course, by W.H. Auden, celebrating the train that flew north from London to Glasgow through the night. The National Ensemble, directed by Lionel Friend, who just managed to keep Nigel Hawthorne on the right tracks. It is a very imaginative use of voice. Spoken voice. Do you know William Walton's Facade?
Yes.
It's the other piece, of course, that manages that as well, sublimely well. Well, William, one of our guests on the programme a couple of years ago was Katie Mellower, and I think you've just been working with her.
I didn't know Katie had done this. Mm. She was a dream to work with. In fact, she really liked Debussy's Sirène from the Nocturnes and was fascinated by the vocals on that. And I know it influenced one of the songs that she did. She's somebody with a very wide love of music of all types.
That's why she was here.
Yes.
That's indeed why you were here, for which, William Orbit, many thanks.
Thank you.
William Orbit was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the comedian and actor Russell Kane. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Sarah Cropper. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the afternoon here on BBC Radio 3, which continues in a couple of minutes with the next in our visits to this year's WOMAD Festival. That's after a summary of the BBC News at 1 o'clock. It's read by David Cornett.
The BBC has learnt that the chief executive of BP, Tony Hayward, is negotiating the terms of his departure from the company. An announcement is due in the next 24 hours. Mr Hayward has faced strong criticism for his leadership of BP during the oil spill crisis in the Gulf of Mexico. Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond has said that the US government preferred the Lockerbie bomber, Abdel Basset Ali al-Megrahi, to be released on compassionate grounds rather than to be returned to Libya as part of the prisoner transfer agreement. Mr. Salmond's statement appears to back a story in the Sunday Times, which claims that the US embassy wrote to the Scottish government advising them that the release was preferable to a transfer to a Libyan jail. Officials in eastern Afghanistan say they know the whereabouts of two missing American servicemen who were reportedly captured by the Taliban. The Taliban say one of them has been killed, although this has not been independently verified. The United States and South Korea have begun naval exercises off the Korean Peninsula, intended as a show of strength to North Korea following the sinking of a South Korean warship in March. 20 ships and 200 planes are taking part. North Korea has threatened retaliation. Investigations are starting after 19 people were killed in a stampede at a music festival in the German city of Duisburg. Most of the victims were trampled in a tunnel at the entrance to the Love Parade. The festival is to be cancelled. The Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has said the BBC needs to show that it's on the same planet as everyone else when it comes to the size of the pay of its top executives. Mr. Hunt said the BBC had made some steps in the right direction, but when ministers had to be careful with every single penny of taxpayers' money, the corporation had to do the same with the licence fee. The weather, it'll be warm but cloudy for much of the UK, with some occasional light rain or drizzle. It'll be driest across South Wales and southwest England. Top temperatures, 26 degrees Celsius. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
David, thank you. And now on BBC Radio 3, we continue our weekend of live broadcasts from the 2010 WOMAD Festival at Charlton Park in Wiltshire. Waiting for us on the Radio 3 stage there is Lucy Duran.
Hello and welcome to another glorious day at WOMAD. Quite a crowd here, as you can hear. In today's programme, we have a bit of a North Africa, Middle Eastern theme. Later on, we'll be hearing from one of the all-time great North African bands, except they're from Paris, the Orchestra National de Barbès. But now, we have a very special musician with us. He's this year's protégé of the World Roots Academy. This is a new Radio 3 project that highlights a specific musical tradition and brings together new and established talent from that culture. This year, the focus is on Iraqi music, and our protégé is a brilliant young oud player whose parents are from Iraq, but he was born in Syria, and then he moved to London when he was 9. Over the past few months, he's been featured quite a lot on World Roots programmes, recorded both in London and the Middle East with a variety of musicians. Today, he's with the Italian master percussionist Andrea Piccioni. So please, a big warm welcome to Khayyam Alami!